Tom Tangney here. This is the Tom and Curly Show. Sherry Elliker filling in for John Curly. We're having a pleasant hours-long discussion, an afternoon conversation, and it's been a lot of fun. We're going to move into a story that John and I, Sherry, kind of previewed yesterday, and I think the results were quite clear. The guy who looks like the guy who stole your girlfriend in high school still is the most popular kid in class. Apparently, we're talking about none other than Gavin Newsom, the somewhat beleaguered governor of California. He faced a recall election last night and won handily, like 2-1. It basically more or less matched the Trump versus Biden vote in California. Obviously, California is a very blue state, very populous state. And in the end, it looked like there was no contest. John and I talked about this a bit yesterday. About a month ago or so, some of the polls seemed to indicate that this was kind of a, you know, almost a toss-up, that Larry Elder, a conservative right-wing radio talk show host, was clearly the alternative choice. There were 46 people running for governor if Gavin Newsom had been recalled, and he indeed, Larry Elder, was head and shoulders above everybody else, and he won without any doubt. Here's a little bit of Gavin Newsom last night at his victory party.
And I think about just in the last, you know, few days, and the former president put out saying this election was rigged. Now, democracy is not a football. You don't throw it around. It's more like antique vase. You could drop it and smash it in a million different pieces. And that's what we're capable of doing if we don't stand up to meet the moment and push back. I said this many, many times on the campaign trail. You know, we may have defeated Trump, but Trumpism is not dead in this country.
Now, that might not resonate with voters in, say, Idaho or any of the Deep South states. But in California, I think the brilliance of Newsom's campaign was to turn this into a referendum, not on himself, but on whether on the specter, I guess, of Trumpism. Because Larry Elder was fully embracing Donald Trump. In fact, he challenged the results as being rigged even before any votes were passed. And before I let you weigh in, let's just hear a little bit of Larry Elder struck a very conciliatory and perhaps surprising, given his rhetoric before the election, a note last night as well.
As you know, my opponent, Governor Gavin Newsom, come on, let's be gracious. Let's be gracious in defeat. And by the way, we may have lost the battle, but we are going to win the war.
Now, he may be a Trumper, but he certainly was more gracious in defeat than his mentor, Donald Trump, was. From clear across the country, Sherry, how does the California gubernatorial recall election look to you?
Well, I wasn't terribly surprised that Gavin Newsom pulled this off. I think the concern was that there wouldn't be a high Democratic turnout because they were worried that people wouldn't come out to support him. But they did. And he did very, very well. Larry Elder would have been elected if they didn't do that. But what I think is kind of interesting is that the recall needed 1.5 million signatures. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, there's 22 million voters in California, and the judge gave them 4 extra months to acquire these signatures. So I
because of the pandemic, by the way.
Because of the pandemic, exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
So I didn't realize how small of a percentage that actually
right.
is for California, and that it really wasn't this enormous, you know, recall in terms of people despising him or thinking he's doing a terrible job. I think there were some dissatisfied people, as there are in any state.
Sure.
But I wasn't surprised that he was able to win. I did look up what Caitlyn Jenner, by the way, my hope for the early front runner from her airplane hangar and all of that, complaining about those pesky homeless as she sits in her airplane hangar. She got 1.2% of the vote, by the way, for anybody keeping score at home. But I do think Larry Elder has been energized by this. And regardless of what you think of him and his politics, I think that he could be a guy that we're going to see again and really probably might give somebody a run for their money, because he certainly did it in this particular race.
Which is great news for Democrats. In California, especially, I would say the best thing for, if you're a partisan Democrat, like I'm happy to say I am, I can't imagine a better candidate to run against Gavin Newsom in another year when he runs for re-election than Larry Elder, because Larry Elder is out of step with the majority of even Republicans, I think, in the state of California. The big hope, and this is the fear from a Democrat's point of view, the fear was, and a fear might be too strong a word, but the concern was that Larry Elder would burn out, would kind of flame out, and then a more moderate Republican or a more traditional Republican, like the San Diego mayor, would be a perfectly fine candidate for the U.S. Senate, that he would then come to the fore and California Republicans would say, listen, if we want to have even the outside chance of winning stealing a seat in this blue state, we have to have somebody that appeals to independents and appeals to maybe more moderate or conservative Democrats. Let's promote the mayor of San Diego. Instead, Larry Elder has already made sounds about how, yes, we haven't lost the war, and that he is planning on running again against Gavin Newsom. I can't imagine the results will be too dissimilar from what we just heard or just saw, which was basically a 2-1 breakdown, which mostly is party lines. There are twice as many Democrats as Republicans in the state of California. That Larry, even if Larry Elder got every single Republican vote, the chances of him winning are next to none, I would think, unless something, if another big scandal broke out with Governor Newsom, which always, I suppose, is a possibility. That's I would be concerned if I was a Republican in the state of California. But still, that's sort of where we stand. Do you think, Sherry, that Gavin Newsom is in a stronger position or a weaker position because of the recall election?
I think he's probably in a stronger position, because I think this has reaffirmed his support, and that people have come out in favor of him. And I think that he is humbled by it, as he should be. And I think that he's probably going to be I think he is going to be stronger for it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that what this does is, so my hunch is if Gavin Newsom, and as slick as he looks on the surface, I'm sure he's a troubled soul like most of us are, then he has nightmares with the words, if not the place, French Laundry, because that is exactly, it's just like John and I had much fun with the campaign ad against him that accused him of, hey, he's just like the high school guy who steals your girlfriend kind of thing. It's like,
and then moves on to the next girl.
Exactly. There's a kind of easy resentment of people that are good looking and are rich and everything else. And the French Laundry incident, in case people don't remember or don't follow California politics that well, on the very day that the judge decided that the recall Gavin Newsom campaign would get 4 more months to gather their signatures, on that very day, after he has announced nobody should be everyone should be masked indoors, he is caught at like the highest end restaurant maybe in the entire state of California, French Laundry, with a bunch of fellow liberals or labor representatives or boosters or whomever, unmasked in that restaurant. It plays into the exact kind of resentment that a lot of people might have about, oh, he's not playing by the rules. He's telling all of us how to play, but he's the principal and no one's going to, you know, tell the principal that she has to or he has to, you know, wear a school uniform. And it's that kind of resentment that I think Gavin Newsom is vulnerable to, because he's a little too, you know, pretty on the outside, mm-hmm. I think. This election, I think, helps puncture that, because he's managed to survive it. And now I think anyone who tries to bring up the French Laundry incident a year and a half from now is going to look like, nah, we already dealt with that. We decided that that wasn't that big enough issue. And I think that from that point of view, it's given him a little bit of Teflon now, a little bit of armor to fight that off. I still don't see him as a national candidate. They said that there was a chance. I mean, after all, you're the governor of California. You immediately have a chance to be put on the national stage for running for president, much like, you know, if you're the governor of New York, you know, everyone knows Andrew Cuomo is going to be the next Democratic nominee. Oops, maybe not. But still, it's a high-profile situation. I just feel like he comes off as a little too slick to be a national candidate for presidential ambitions. Again, I don't know how you feel about that. Do you think he has the potential, or do you see the touchiness of a national campaign for him?
I don't think he does. And I think for all the reasons that you stated, and also a lot of people just think California as a state is a liability because of all of the, you know, if you're not very progressive, if you don't believe in the mandates, you don't believe in the things that he tried to implement, and some that, you know, that weren't as popular there, but got put forward anyway, then you are going to think of a lot of people still believe California is kind of this crazy
kooky
place. And that, you know, that it's really not. It doesn't have strong leadership, and it hasn't had strong leadership. So I think that's going to be
a
problem for him. But I also agree with what you're saying, is this guy is very attractive, and so you just kind of, there's kind of the little bit of the slicky boy problem, you know, where he's just a little too slick for his own good. And so I don't think he's going to have a national profile. An election type thing, you know, for president.
Yeah. And in reference to your characterization of California, I like the AP's version of California as a laboratory for progressive policies. I think that's a great way to sort of sum up that state. And then just finally, just because the English major in me loves a good metaphor, what did you think of the antique vase a metaphor for a democracy in this country?
Well, I liked the way that he pretended that he was just thinking of that, and he didn't. So he pretended, he said, it's not a football. It's kind of
it's
like
a,
how do you say, an antique vase,
you
know.
Yeah,
so that I don't believe that he just came up with that. I think he was trying to sound extemporaneous, but it was something that was written for him. And that, again, is probably why there's a little distrust of this guy, because he is
very
just a,
good.
Yeah,
it's a little
sleazy.
A little too perfect. A metaphor. Very good. Okay, well, let's jumping from one from, say, a liberal Democrat. I don't know how progressive he's seen in California. I mean, obviously he's progressive by national standards, but let's move from him to an even more a very out and proud progressive, someone from our state. I don't know how familiar you are with Pramila Jayapal, but in a matter of very few years, she has suddenly risen to the top and is now the top spokesman for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. A BuzzFeed has come out with kind of a takedown article. It's sort of a hit job, but I think it's the journalism that's gone into this is legitimate enough. They contact over a dozen former staffers who talk about what they consider, and there are different ways of to interpret this or say this, but the hypocrisy of Pramila Jayapal, and that is that she is a champion of the worker. That is one thing that she is like her calling card, that she's always working at, like a good progressive, you know, working for the down and out worker who is not getting his fair share from the corporate overlords. yards, let's say. And in this particular case, this BuzzFeed article cites dozens of, or at least over a dozen, former staffers who say she is impossible to work for, that she drives everyone so hard, she berates the staff in public sometimes, reduces some of them to tears. She doesn't pay, you know, at least, you know, one of them much money, demands that they're always available to drive her around. This is a pretty damning report from an insider's position on what it's like to work for Pramila Jayapal. What was your overall take, given, granted, that most of what they say, I think, is pretty well documented? I'm not sure there's too much dispute about what the individuals are saying. The question is, how significant or important should we be taking those complaints?
Well, what they talk about here, Tom, is I think fairly typical. I know from having lived in the D.C. area most of my life and knowing a lot of people that went into Capitol Hill type employment where they got out of college and that was what they wanted to do. They wanted to be a staffer. They wanted to rise through the ranks of, mm-hmm. you know, of politics and try to get in on the ground floor. And what happens is, you know, they'll eat you up and spit you out. I mean, that has been right. going on since the beginning of time, since the beginning of Capitol Hill. There is nothing new here as far as people being, you know, overworked and underpaid. And that's how they pay their dues. So mm-hmm. I know that she is very much a champion of workers' rights, but I don't think this makes her a hypocrite. I think that this makes her pretty, you know, a standard in terms of being an employer with a really tough job, with a lot of people that are going to be unhappy. About the only thing that I thought was a little bit strange was they cited so many people having to go into therapy because of her. And so, but I think, okay, you're 25, 26, you're in a high stress job during a pandemic. How much of that is really about her and how much of that is just a sign of the times?
Well, so also, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I didn't think it was the stinging indictment that BuzzFeed wants it to be.
You know, and speaking to that bit, you know, the 25, 26-year-old, I did think it was interesting that it said, yes, these tough conditions have been around since time immemorial, but this generation, the millennial generation, they're not about to put up with it, that tough conditions and low pay, rite of passage, that millennials say they're now less willing to accept these undignified working conditions. I thought, yeah, I think that's a good thing. That's a fine thing. If millennials manage to, at the age of 24, 25, say, wait a minute, you can't treat me like dirt. Don't tell me I've got to, you know, pay my wages. A lot of people think, oh, the millennials are just spoiled. Well, in some cases, maybe it's, they're resisting being taken advantage of, like most of us of our eras, you know, we're willing to do as a way of paying our dues. So anyway, it's an interesting article. You can check it out. Yeah, I think that people that support Jayapal's politics probably are not going to be that disturbed. And, you know, it's true. All of us could be nicer and, you know, we wish that for every staffer, no matter, you know, where they're from or what party they're representing. Okay,
absolutely.
I hear Tracy's music. Tracy, how are we doing out there? You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Sherry Elliker filling in for John today. And this next topic, I think the one thing that Sherry and I have in common, like a lot of people in our age group, and Sherry, I grant that you're younger than I am, but we've had many years of relationship experience. And this topic, Atlantic does a great job. They usually have articles that are very in-depth on all sorts of political topics and social topics. And the one we're going to talk about right now is something called The Secret to a Fight Free Relationship. The premise is, and we've had so much to say in our pre-show meeting, we realized we could probably do an hour on this, but I just want to lay out the basic argument of this particular approach. And they've got lots of cognitive therapists and psychologists weighing in on, you know, the legitimacy of these. And they profile a number of couples. But the couple I want to focus on, at least initially, is the one that they start off with. So The thrust of the article is that in general, we've kind of, it's common conventional wisdom that the best thing to do is to not bottle up your feelings. That if something is really bothering you, it's only worse if you bottle them up, if you suppress them, because then it'll explode on you or your partner or both of you almost unexpectedly. So the better to vent and get it out of your system, it's kind of cathartic. And this article is profiling people, couples, long-term successful couples who say just the opposite. So this is the thing that they profile. There's this particular couple. They're both very chatty. It sounds like they're both very, well-educated and all this. So they have a lot to draw on when they have their arguments. One's Catholic, one's Jewish, and they have there are all sorts of interesting dynamics between them. Their first meeting or second meeting, it was like a five-hour debate between them. So these are talkers in general. This isn't like you've got the silent man and the talkative woman and they're in conflict. These are people that like to engage. But what they've decided they do, they realize that most of the time when they were together, and again, this is early on in their relationship, that they were always arguing. Not necessarily fighting, but a lot of times that can veer into fighting. And their solution to it was this. Instead of fighting, they would write down on a piece of paper, whatever's handy, on a napkin, on a loose envelope, whatever, they would write down their grievance in effect, and they would sit on it for an entire year. They would have one day a year. This reminds me a bit of Seinfeld, where you express your grievances right around Christmas time. They would meet once a year and go over all of these scraps of paper and express their grievances. And the reason they think this worked so well, and apparently it did for this couple, was that none of them were interested in scoring points. One of the things, at least in a good relationship, it feels like in a marital spats are great, in that you try to score points, like they're rhetorical points, like you're trying to win a debate rather than actually solve a problem. Whereas if you wait an entire year or up to a year before this can be, these disputes can be discussed, it allows you to simmer down, to not be so upset, and actually look at it from, with a little more perspective, where you can raise the issue, and if the two of you involved both acknowledge, hear each other out, you can resolve these issues, because the point isn't to score rhetorical gotchas. It's more to find common ground where you can solve things. And this couple, after I think it's like 40 years of marriage, have done this throughout their marriage, although some of the check-in days have adjusted. Anyway, that's the basic premise. Both Sherry and I had strong reactions to it. Sherry, I'll let you go first.
Well, so I told you in our pre-show meeting that one of the things that I have also done in my life is I was trained in conflict resolution. And I have
perfect. Hilarious.
I have a certificate in this. And this kind of flies in the face of that a little bit, in that conflict resolution talks about making sure that if you have a conflict, that it's dealt with pretty quickly, because things tend, when they tend to fester, they tend to get worse. And so when you have something, you don't want it to get to what they call a crisis point, where you're in this, terrible situation, where if you had just made it aware, if you made somebody aware of it when it was a little problem, it wouldn't become a big problem. But what they're talking about here, I think, if you can do it, it's great. I mean, these people have these contract talks every 3 months now, and they have rules of engagement where you don't shut down the other person's observations. You have to be prepared to hear criticism. You have to admit your faults. You have to be very calm, all these things. I think that's fantastic. Can I do that? Absolutely not. I mean, there's no way.
Why not? I just can't
because, I mean, and most of the time, that's the thing. It's like most of the arguments I have with my husband are petty little things. They're not they're not big, huge. How are we going to, get through this type of things? It's stuff like, I told you the dogs needed to go out at 4:30, that type of stuff. Right.
It's so, 4:35. You're five minutes late.
4:31, if you ask me. So it's usually littler stuff. But, we sort of, have those moments, and I get upset with him and he gets upset with me, and then it's done and it's over with. And so that's kind of our system. So I don't think this is a bad system. I just know that it would never work in my marriage because we couldn't sit on it that long. How about you?
Yeah, well, I think even in this sort of it really feels like kind of an idealistic approach to relationship issues. I mean, if you can really pull it off, bully for them. But even these people, these paragons of relationship virtues, they realize after a couple of years, waiting an entire year is just too darn long.
Right.
We need to at least do it every 3 months. And I thought, okay, that's good. And the philosophy behind it is not that, you know, you're right. The what you're concerned about and what conflict resolution is about is you don't want things to fester because they can get worse. Supposedly, the philosophy behind this is if you know they're not going to fester, if you know that come June 1st, I'll be able to air, you know, my grievances or whatever with that person, then it kind of lets the air out of the balloon or the steam out of through the vents, because you know, okay, it's not like I'm repressing this and will never get to have my say. I just have to wait a couple of months, and then you put it in perspective. Because most of us who've had any, and all of us, I would say, anybody who's ever been in a relationship, and this could even be a parent-child relationship, I suspect, too, not just, spousal partners or, you know, dating teams. The thing is that almost all of our arguments are not about what we're arguing about. It just feels like there's something else that we're trying to get at. Again, like I hear the music coming up. So we're just going to have to kind of like suggest people check out this article. I do think there are a couple of other things, though, that we just mentioned really quickly. And this, I think most of us would agree with. They cite one therapist who says we should treat our relationships like our teeth.
Right. I love that.
Yes.
I thought that was really interesting.
Yes. Preventive treatment. It's like we're doing this. We're setting aside a particular day for a contract talk, in effect, because that is the way we won't have to have all our teeth pulled. We'll have them a regular cleaning, something like that. I also like this idea that usually, and this, I think, is the case in a lot of instances, there's a pursuer and a distancer, somebody who wants to talk and somebody who just, that's the last thing they want to do. And they say the nice thing about this as a solution is that if you're the one who always wants to talk, at least you can be reassured that come June 1st, we will get that talk. And if you're one of the people that just said, oh, my God, not another relationship talk, you can think, oh, at least I don't have to talk about it until June 1st.
Right.
And so it actually satisfies both parties. And that's one of the philosophies behind it. This whole idea of scheduled disagreements, it's really a provocative and intriguing discussion. And again, I think we've just barely scratched the surface. But so far, so good. The secret to a fight-free relationship. It's even interesting, even if you disagree with them. When I first broached the subject with Sherry, I said, I don't know, this seems kind of nutty to me offhand.
Right.
it feels kind of, to me, bloodless. But
ooh,
it works
really?
For these. Yeah,
yeah,
well, the thing is that you all of your concerns really can just be dealt with by putting it off for a couple months. I don't know. It just feels like it feels too programmatic. I would not want to be in a relationship that is that programmatic. It's not June 1st yet. You know, hold your fire. It feels a little forced. But then maybe sometimes, especially if you have relationship problems, maybe doing something forced will, help resolve some of those problems. It's not a cure-all, but certainly a good discussion. Okay,
yeah.
Take it away, Tracy. Welcome back to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here, Sherry Elliger filling in for John. The constant story of the last year and a half, maybe, a little more than that now, has obviously been COVID-19. And there's this little interesting wrinkle in terms of the industry that's dealing with COVID. As a result of the Biden administration's order that most large companies should mandate their workers to either be vaccinated or be screened weekly, suddenly there is a real demand for rapid tests. Now, Abbott Laboratories, these are these rapid antigen tests that you can find out if you have COVID based on whether your body has produced antigens. quickly enough. It takes only like 15 minutes, and it's a way to quickly find out, just verify that you indeed have not come down with COVID. And the Abbott Laboratories, it kind of shut down. Remember, once the vaccines came out, and most people or a lot of people were vaccinated by June, Abbott Laboratories realized there wasn't really this this demand. Well, now Wall Street Journal talks about how they're in short supply all of a sudden, and they're ramping up productions because so many people are now wanting to get access to these rapid tests just to kind of prove their viability for work. One of the kind of odd wrinkles of this most recent effort by the Biden administration to tamp down the transmission of COVID.
It's going to be difficult, Tom, because a lot of these things haven't been made clear yet. For instance, who's going to pay for the tests? Is the employer going to pay for it? Is the employee going to pay for it?
True.
And if they have to do this weekly, and we go back to where we were, say, back in the, I guess, last summer or in the winter even, it's going to be really, really hard. Because remember, it took days and sometimes weeks to get the test results. That was a big problem. Now, they say that as of September 6th, the U.S. is processing more than 1.2 million a day.
A day.
So, but that's before a lot of these mandates are really kicking in.
Yes.
So I don't know how they're going to manage all of that. I mean, and what will employers require? Will it be enough to take the rapid test? Will they have to do the PCR test? Or, I mean, this is going to, I see this to be quite an interesting a little problem that's going to be on the horizon.
Yeah, Stan, you know, my wife ordered one, you know, this was a couple months ago, just because she was curious and thought it might come in handy. And then this summer, my brother got one of those dings. He signed up on this phone that if he was in the vicinity, let's say he went to Bartels or went to a game or something, and there was somebody who later tested, positive for COVID, he got a little ding. And so, oh my God. So he had to go in for a test. Well, my daughter happened to be visiting New York and had seen seen her uncle. And said, oh, criminy. And so luckily she took that rapid antigen test, and it showed that she was clear and my brother was clear. So it was just one of those warnings. But yeah, you realize how handy they are. So my wife decided to order some more online, and she couldn't. They were basically out. So yeah, there's that industry is going to be ramping up, and hopefully sooner rather than later we'll have enough as needed. Okay, it's I hear Tracy's traffic music. How do we, the bed, how does it look out there right now, Tracy?